Blessings to you all for being here this morning. We gathered here in the name of Jesus, and we want him to be honored. Beautiful to have a reprieve from our record heat of last week, and just should do something to lift our spirits, if nothing else. And I trust there'll be a lot more than that. This morning we want to continue looking into the Word of God. Let's turn our Bibles to Matthew chapter 24. And this is where most of the message will be coming from. And I'll read verse 3 just as an introduction. I've titled the message this morning, The Signs of His Coming. And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, Tell us, when shall be these things be, and what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? Now, don't expect a lot of fantastic predictions and mind-twisting interpretations. It's going to be very simple, because Jesus gave it that way, and I think that's the way it should be understood. There's a lot of people that have a lot to say about end times, and they miss the most important part. And so that's what we want to focus on this morning, is the important part. So here in this context, there was a four-day period after the triumphal entry of Jesus into Jerusalem until his crucifixion. And during that four-day period, he faced a lot of questions. He did a lot of teaching. And so here we see him presenting an astounding amount of teaching in a very short time and in a concentrated way. And we find this period of time represented in both the Gospel of Matthew and John. In Matthew, it'll be like from chapter 21 until chapter 26. And in John, it will be chapter 13 through chapter 17. And in Matthew, most of it happens before the Last Supper. And in John, most of it happens during and after the Last Supper that he presented this teaching. And so he gave these teachings both publicly and privately to his disciples. A lot of it here in Matthew was talking to the rulers of the Jews. He had cleansed the temple. He was being challenged by what authority he did these things. And he was had a lot of things to say there to them, which they, many of them, mostly rejected it. And so much of what we have recorded here in chapter 24 is a private conversation directly to his disciples. And so what we see here in Matthew 24, verse 3, is what I tend to take the message mainly from, is what he was giving in answer to the his disciples' question about, tell us, when shall these things be, and when shall be, what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? And as we see the events of our time shaping up, we would have to at least conclude that we're closer than we were yesterday, and that probably it's very close. And the thrust of the message is to be prepared. And so some of the discussion was regarding specifically the destruction of Jerusalem and its temple. But the primary question that was asked here reached on beyond the conditions in the world, and that it reached beyond that to the conditions of the world and the events that would herald the return of Christ and the end of the world. When I was born in 1951, the world population was just over 2 billion, and today, world population is now 8 billion plus, and so we have four times more people living in the world today than we did when I was born. and the population intends to compound and increase rapidly. And I think that in itself also impacts some of the things that Jesus was talking about there that would happen before his coming. At the time I was born, it was a time period just following the two world wars. In World War I, there were 18 to 23 million people that lost their lives. In World War II, it was 60 to 80 million. And so what about the 20 million in between? You know, they're significant as well. Nobody really knows for sure. But the degree of human suffering during those periods of time cannot be calculated. It was, you know, we have books, we can read stories, life stories of people who went through that period of time, and it's heart-wrenching what many of them endured and went through. And so it was a very significant and a dark time in history. But, you know, from 1951, I grew up in an environment of relative peace and prosperity, as well as most of you have, if not all of you, have grown up in a time of peace and prosperity. And so we have not been as directly affected by these statistics as millions and millions of other people have. But it doesn't make them less of less consequence. But the thing that comes out of that is we living in a time of peace and prosperity. Have we been lulled into passivity and lethargy as a result, or will we take the words of Jesus seriously as it regards the end time and the need for preparedness and vigilance, lest we be caught unprepared? Now, he also addresses that scenario in Matthew chapter 24 here. If we look over in verse 36, he says, "But of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered into the ark, and knew not until the flood came and took them all away, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be." And so there's also that aspect that life will be going on pretty much as normal. There will be conditions existing in the world that are of tremendous consequence, but for many people, life will be going on as normal, just like it is for us presently. And then in verse 44 of that same chapter, he says, "Then shall they also," I'm looking at chapter 25, verse 44 of chapter 24, "Therefore, be ye also ready, for in such an hour as ye think not, the Son of Man cometh." Now, there are many scriptures, both in the Gospels, which is Jesus' teaching, and throughout the New Testament writings, including the book of Revelation, that speak of the end time conditions and the need to be prepared and to be vigilant. That is the word for us as we approach the end times, to be prepared and to be vigilant. And time won't allow us to look at these many references to Christ's return and the conditions prior to his coming, although I may turn to some just for the sake of comparison or clarity. And so there are 10 things that Jesus mentions here in Matthew 24 that will be happening at the time of his return, either immediately preceding it or happening at the time of his return. And I want to look at those 10 things. And we will start here in verse 4. "And Jesus answered and said unto them, Take heed that no man deceive you, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. Now, throughout the scripture, it is emphasized that the time of the end will be a time of great deception. We have it verified in numerous writings throughout the New Testament. But I would like to save this and address it along with verse 11 that we'll come to later on that talks about the deception and the falling away. And so the next thing he mentions here is in verse 6. He says, "And ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom." And so the end, time of the end will be a time of warfare. There'll be a lot of wars. Today, there are 32 ongoing conflicts in the world right now, ranging from drug wars to terrorists to insurgencies, ethnic conflicts, civil wars, and border conflicts. And the I'm giving a lot of statistics here, and these are numbers. But remember that numbers represent people. And you can put yourself in the shoes of those that are going through these things right now. These are current issues. Probably the war that we're most familiar with and have been watching the most closely because of the possibility of escalation is the war in Ukraine. And so I'm going to look at that just a little bit here. These are some statistics that I've found. Presently, and this is very current, there have been 42,000 civilians killed. Now, if that was your father or mother or son or daughter, that would be a big deal. And we're saying 42,000. Those numbers just roll off of us because it's hard to comprehend. And then besides that, in the Ukrainian forces, in the military, 70,000 killed, 100,000 to 120,000 wounded. That's an estimate by the U.S. And then, but that's not the end. That's not the only repercussions. In the country of Poland, which borders Ukraine, it borders Hungary and Romania as well, and also Moldova. But at the border crossings in Poland from Ukraine, around 13.7 million people have crossed those borders as of July 2023. 13.7 million people fleeing from Ukraine into other countries to fleeing from the conflict and the war and the consequences of it. Can you imagine 13.7 million people who have been displaced because of what's going on there? And that doesn't include Russia, Hungary, and Romania, which have also received a large number of those refugees. One of the last times we were in Romania, we took friends out to eat at a little resort restaurant in the town of Valug. It's a kind of a resort town in the mountains. And our waiter came to us to take our menus and stuff, and he couldn't speak Romanian. He could only speak English, which of course we understood, and that was unusual. So we of course started to inquire and found out that he was a Ukrainian, and he had fled with his family. His village was the third that had been overcome by the Russians as they made their push into Ukraine, and they got out just in time. And he had his wife and child. And so here he was in Romania, couldn't speak Romanian. Somebody had mercy on him and gave him a job as a waiter. He was an educated man as in this little restaurant. And so he pled with us if we could not possibly somehow get in contact with the Ukrainian community in America and find him some help, and which we did. We made contact and found out that they were already so overwhelmed with these kind of requests that they said, we can't help him. I still have his contact information in my pocket, but this is only one family, husband, wife, and a little child. Millions are in his shape because of the war. And so, warfare. The next one he talks about is famines there. After the wars, he said there's going to be wars and there's going to be famines. Here in March 13th, which is this year of 2023, here is a statistic. Nearly 350 million people around the world are experiencing the most extreme forms of hunger right now. Of those, nearly 49 million people are on the brink of starvation. Now, again, put yourself in that situation. You have a family, you have a wife, you have children. You have a husband, you have children, you have a father and a mother. And put yourself in that situation that where is the next meal going to come from? You know, we had a little bit of an experience here with COVID where there was supply issues and the grocery stores couldn't stock all the items that they normally have, and some of the grocery stores shelves were empty because of it. But it's nothing compared to what 49 million people in the world are facing, that they don't know where the next meal is. What would we do if it was us? In 2 weeks' time, if everything was shut down and the grocery stores were empty, where would you go for your next meal? Chances are we could hold out a little longer, but we're used to just having it right there, and we're used to having it in abundance. But he said there's going to be famines, and there are famines. Behind these massive statistics are individual children, women, and men suffering from the dire effects of such severe hunger. Here's a quote. The world faces one of the most cruel and devastating crises of our time, hunger. And it's being caused by soaring food prices driven by the war in Ukraine, persistent drought. You know, here about mid-July, it was dry here. And, I had about a half a hay crop in the spring. My pasture was depleted. And it looked like I was going to have to start feeding hay early out of a half a hay crop. And, you know, we were praying, but we weren't on the brink of starvation. But there's a lot of countries in the world where they didn't get rain. God sent us abundant rain. He blessed us with 5 inches of rain. And yesterday, again, almost an inch. And everything is green and lush, and things are looking much more promising. Then I was going to have to buy a couple hundred bales of hay and didn't know what. Maybe sell all my cows. But anyway, nothing in comparison to what many people in the world are facing today in food shortages and hunger. Driven by war, persistent drought, other extreme events, regional wars, and ongoing impacts of COVID-19. Are causing these hunger to escalate worldwide. The next thing he mentions is pestilences, there in verse 7. Well, we don't have to go back very far in our memory to know what a pestilence can do in the worldwide COVID epidemic. And I'm not going to bring up a lot of others. There are many other diseases and things that are in focus as well. We had the HIV AIDS thing and other things that have hit the world globally. This is globally as of 6:30 p.m. Central Eastern Standard Time, the 16th of August, 2023. Is that last week? There have been 769,806,130 confirmed cases of COVID-19 and probably ended up being a lot more than that. These are confirmed cases. And there's a lot of speculation. There were a lot of miscounting and all of that. We know that, but we know that it was big. Including 6,955,497 deaths reported to World Health Organization as of 20th August 23. A total of 13,499,865,692 vaccine doses have been administered. Is it big? You know, should it, has it caught the attention of the world, of the people? It was a pestilence, and it still is. The next thing he mentions is earthquakes, there in verse 7 as well. Now, this is an up-to-date statistic as well. In the year 2023, which is our year that we're living in right now, up to today, there have been 98 earthquakes of significant magnitude that were reported worldwide. And Jesus says they'll be in diverse places, and they're happening all over the world. Of these, the February 6th earthquake in Turkey and Syria was the most devastating. There were 45,968 confirmed deaths in Turkey and 7,259 in Syria, which is just across the border, for a combined total of 53,227 deaths. Now here again, we roll these numbers off, and they seem, they're just numbers to us. But put yourself in the place of a family that was living securely, had an apartment, a house, relatives, family, everything was going well, and in a moment's time, they lost it all. And where were they going to go? What were they going to do? 15.73 million people have been impacted by these earthquakes. Millions of people in Turkey and Syria are in urgent need of humanitarian support. Cities across the region suffered widespread destruction, with nearly 50,000 buildings, including apartment buildings, schools, and hospitals, now in ruins. The loss of safe housing and access to school is making children more vulnerable to exploitation, abuse, and family separation. The situation in Syria is worsening, it's not getting better, as many families continue to live in temporary shelters. Approximately 265,000 people still need proper housing since their homes were destroyed. Many of them are living in tents. And just last month, the month of July, the crisis is further intensified by scorching summer heat with temperatures exceeding 104 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, we know a little bit about heat this summer, but we could go in our air-conditioned house and get relief. But what about a tent, living in a tent in that heat? Just imagine. And this has led to devastating fires, with over 40 incidents triggered by the soaring temperatures between July 15th and July 17th. In 2023, more than 180 fire incidents have been reported, resulting in 5 deaths and damage to more than 220 tents. Okay, Jesus said there was going to be earthquakes. Was he right? Is it happening today? The next is Christian persecution. In verse 9, he says, then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and ye shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. So there's going to be an increase of persecution in the last days of Christians. And we read about this even in secular media articles. Globally, more than 360 million Christians suffer at least high levels of persecution and discrimination for their faith. Now, that is, again, a number that we can hardly wrap our minds around. 360 million people who wake up every morning not knowing for sure what's going to happen because they're Christians, for their Christian faith. In 1993, 30 years ago, Christians faced high to extreme levels of persecution in 40 countries. Now, in just 30 years, this number has nearly doubled to 76 countries in 2023. In the top 50 alone, 312 million Christians now face very high or extreme levels of persecution. I'm just reading off these statistics here. Worldwide, one in seven Christians now experience at least high levels of persecution or discrimination, with one in five in Africa, two out of five in Asia, and one in 15 in Latin America. And here is a report that was released by the World Watch List in 2021, which is 2 years ago. Every day, 13 Christians worldwide are killed because of their faith. And here again, we put ourselves into that situation. If that was your father, if that was your pastor, if that was your family member, it would be big, wouldn't it? And it is big. It is big. And they are our brothers in the faith. 13 Christians killed worldwide every day. Every day, 12 churches or Christian buildings are attacked. Every day, 12 Christians are unjustly arrested or imprisoned, and another 5 are abducted. The total number of Christians killed for their faith so far in 2023 stands at 5,621. The total number of Christians abducted for faith-related reasons increased from 3,829 recorded cases in 2022 to 5,259 in so far 2023. So we see a huge increase there in the amount of abductions and arrests made to Christians. And so again, a confirmation of what Jesus was saying. And then in verse 10, he says, "And then shall many be offended and shall betray one another and shall hate one another." Now this is talking about a falling away. Many shall be offended. That means they're going to decide to give up and quit and leave. And they're going to betray one another and hate one another. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3, it says, "Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first." And then in verse 10, he says, "Because they received not the love of the truth, that they might be saved." And so that gives the reason. There's going to be a falling away because they did not love the truth. And they became discouraged and left. 2 Timothy 3:13, "But evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived." Here are some more statistics. 40 million Americans have stopped attending church in the past 25 years. That's something like 12% of the population, and it represents the largest concentrated change in church attendance in American history. Some time ago, we attended a church that we simply didn't have. It was an unusual circumstance, and we attended a church that was in the locality in which we were. It had been a church much like ours 50 years ago, but in the meantime, they had lost all form of Christian identity as far as their dress, their appearance, like anyone else that you would meet on the street. And so in that service, there was mostly older people, older couples. There was a few young couples with children and some in between. But where were the youth? Where were the youth? They were non-existent. They weren't there. And it was an old, well-established Mennonite community. And this was what we found. And it's what's happening. It's It's what's happening nationwide in our country. Many churches are having to close their doors. Many of them consist of older people who've always gone to church. The young people have lost interest. Since the 1990s, large numbers of Americans have left Christianity to join the growing ranks of U.S. adults who describe their religious identity as atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular. Have you gotten any of those questionnaires in the mail? I have. Taking a poll of where you are in relation to your religious identity. 1 Timothy 4:1, "Now speaketh the Spirit expressly that in the latter times some shall depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of devils." This accelerating trend is reshaping the U.S. religious landscape. This is a quote now. "Christian America isn't dying," he says, "it's dividing." Major denominations are accepting the devious lifestyles of the LGBTQ community, and it's a divisiveness that is brought on by the same spirit that we're facing in the country, in our nation. Those of the progressive mindset you don't have to be very alert in politics to see that our country is polarized and it's divided. And it has much to do with the progressive mindset of those who are promoting these alternative things. And so this goes in churches now, from simple tolerance to using them in church leadership positions. And it's causing a lot of divisions in the churches across the nation. The next one we find in verse 11, he says, "Many false prophets shall rise and shall deceive many." And then in verse 24, he says, "For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that if it were possible, they should deceive the very elect." So we have here false prophets that are bringing in deception. Now, a question here: is a partial gospel the true gospel? Is a partial gospel good enough? Is a partial gospel going to get us to heaven? And I want to clarify that by reading an article, or just excerpts from an article that I read here a while back, and it is somewhat lengthy, so listen, but I think I need to read all of what I have here in order for it to make sense. But he's answering this question, you know, what is more dangerous? A bottle clearly marked poison, or a mislabeled bottle that contains poison? Which is more dangerous? A wolf that looks like a wolf, or a wolf that looks like a sheep? Which is more dangerous? And that's what Jesus is warning us about here. And here is now what I wanted to read. "There are great blessings in belonging to the Anabaptist community. However, in the minds of some, the beliefs of the Anabaptist faith unnecessarily restrict them from worldly freedoms that other Christians enjoy. Why then should we be conservative Anabaptists when it isn't necessary in order to get to heaven? We see many non-Anabaptist Christians around us who name the name of Christ as their Savior. They pray, study the Bible, and attend church. We read their books, listen to their testimonies, and see changed lives. They preach the gospel, and souls are saved through their witness. We assume that they are heaven-bound. Yet many teach that some of our deeply held Anabaptist beliefs, such as non-resistance, the two-kingdom concept, refusal of divorce and remarriage, separation from the world, modesty, and the headship veiling are non-essentials as far as the Lord Jesus is concerned. In their view, these are simple traditions that are not necessary to get to heaven. Strictly speaking, these are not Anabaptist doctrines, they are Bible doctrines. However, given that the Anabaptists are the largest group in the USA that uphold these truths, we will call them Anabaptist doctrines for the sake of clarity. These were truths that provoked the desire of the founders of the Anabaptist movement to reestablish the doctrines of the early church. In other words, for these doctrines, many were willing to lay their lives on the line to uphold them. Laying aside the non-Anabaptist people position, for they have their work and calling to do, now considering the following question. Can those of us who were born in Anabaptist homes and were taught these things from childhood knowingly decide to ignore them and still go to heaven? We should include those also those non-Anabaptists who the Lord has convicted on these issues. May they decide too that they are unnecessary after all, disregard them and still get to heaven. Those are questions that he's asking. If we consider the New Testament teaching honestly, I think we are compelled to believe that God expects Christians to observe these doctrines, obviously allowing some range for their exact interpretation and application. Why else would he include them in his eternal word? So to intentionally stop observing them is to go against the New Testament teaching, which is sin. James 4:17 says, "To him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. Will such a person be worthy of heaven and see with joy the face of our Savior and Lord?" In this same regard, I think of the verses in Luke 12:47-48. "And that servant which knew his Lord's will and prepared not himself, neither did according to his will, shall be beaten with many stripes, but he that knew not and did commit things worthy of stripes shall be beaten with few stripes. For unto whomsoever much is given of him shall be much required." So clearly God holds those with knowledge of his will to a higher standard than to those with less knowledge or maybe no knowledge at all. Despite the scriptural teaching, an increasing number of Anabaptists are rejecting the Anabaptist teachings and following the Protestant churches. Does God approve? Many have done so and nothing has happened. Lightning hasn't fallen from heaven upon them. They haven't been struck with sudden horrible illness. Life goes on normally. But is that a safe confirmation of God's approval? Is it for a greater walk with God that people leave? We must not forget that to become more spiritual is to be more filled with the Spirit of Jesus Christ, which is to be like him in all his teaching and life, and not less so. And concluding paragraph, growing toward perfection is a Christian mandate and goal. Some learn truth starting from zero and take years to reach the knowledge and insights that others receive quickly through special training or through heritage. And hindrances to learning truth, such as one's personal background, his social settings, or prior teaching, make it necessary for us to be very careful to let God do the evaluation of one's personal responsibility. Let's remember that there is a difference between rebellion and immaturity. That's very significant. And so how deeply accountable is the Anabaptist Christian who from childhood has been gifted with a godly heritage and much precious truth? Will God bless the one who rejects these truths for instant food, which may be physically gratifying, but spiritually is a bowl of porridge? I'm not going to make a lot of comments on that article. I agree with it 100%. And so I'm just going to say in regards to that, beware of books and blogs. We can glean a lot of good, but remember that it only takes a drop of poison to kill you. And it can be disguised in something that tastes very good. So just make sure. The Bible must be the measure and standard of all Christian doctrine and teachers of doctrine. Go back to the Bible if you have a question. Most of those people, we don't know their lives that they live besides what we see. Okay, then he says in verse 12, and because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. Iniquity shall abound. We look at the environment today. Does it trouble you, the drug crisis that's facing our country? Thousands are dying from drug overdoses and lives wrecked. Homeless crisis, migration crisis, violent crime crisis, defund the police, decriminalize crime, domestic violence, all these negative reports. It's just simply confirming what Jesus says, iniquity shall abound. And then in verse 14, and this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. Well, that's a little bit more of a positive note there. The gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world. Is that being fulfilled today? With modern means of travel and the use of electronic media, the whole world has indeed become reachable by the gospel in ways that no one could have dreamed of or imagined just not that long ago. We can basically be almost anywhere in the world in one day if we board a plane and we can fly here and there. We can be there in a day. It has become very, very doable. The world needs those who are willing to teach and to show how true Christianity is to be believed and lived out. And that's where you and I come in. God is depending on us to teach and to show, to demonstrate true Christianity to the world around us. It doesn't mean we have to go out of the borders of our country or state or even our town in order to do that. But we need those who are willing to teach and to show how true Christianity is to be lived out. And as we look at the overall aspect of foreign missions, you know, are we seeing a diminishing interest for mission outreach? I think the New Testament pattern is both humanitarian aid as well as church planting. And in church planting is where the real grunt work comes in. We can go and hand out food parcels and come back home again. And we can have literature and things that we pass out and leave again. But there's a place for that. But the real grunt work comes in helping those new believers to organize and to be a church, to be a functioning body. And I have just been so blessed by the work in Bangladesh there that started out in such a small way, and today over 200 members that have come to the Lord as a result. And these are mostly former Muslims and converts from Muslim, and I'm not sure about Hindus, but that's the way it should work. That's the way it should work. Okay, here are some concluding thoughts. A large part of the theme of Jesus' teaching relates to believers. He's talking to us, not talking to the unbelievers, but he's talking to us. He was talking to his disciples, and trusting we are those as well. How we should live, and warnings of vigilance and doctrinal soundness. So he's talking about how we should live. Remember in John 15, there between the Last Supper and his crucifixion, he was talking about fruit bearing, how that his people should be bearing fruit. And if we're not bearing fruit, then we're dead and we will be pruned out. And so fruit bearing is a very important part of that, how we should live. And we have that parable here in Matthew 24, verse 14 to 30, talks about the talents, how he gave out the talents, and there was an increase. But the one just buried his talent, and there was no increase. And that one, he says there in verse 30, and then shall appear this, wait, I'm in the wrong chapter here, I think. Well, I don't have time to go there right now. But you know, the parable of the talents there, and the one who buried his talent, and finally, you know, the Lord said to cast him out, and there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. He was rejected because he did not bear fruit. And so that was that is included here in this package of teaching, is that we need to be busy bearing fruit. And then the other point was that of doctrinal soundness, how we should walk in truth. We have here in this same period of time, we have the 10 virgins given, where 5 had sufficient oil and 5 did not. And the 5 that did not have were locked out. And when the door was shut, he said, I never knew you. And they were not allowed entrance. And we have others in John. Also, again, same period of time. In chapter 14, verse 21, he says, he that hath my commandments and keepeth them, he it is that loveth me, and he that loveth me shall be loved of my Father, and I will love him and will manifest myself to him. So if we want God's, if we want to know God's will, if we want spiritual enlightenment, it comes as we yield ourselves to the light that we already have. We have, this is not in this context, but in Matthew chapter 7, there are the last few verses. After he gives the Sermon on the Mount and all those doctrines that I talked about here a week, some time ago, he says that the one who, it's not those who say, Lord, Lord, but it's those who do the will of my Father that are going to be saved. Now, going back to Matthew 24 here, in conclusion, verse 13, he says, but he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. Now, that word endure connotates endurance, doesn't it? It means to patiently keep on. And even though we are swimming upstream, we're not taking the easy road. But we are keeping on, and we're not giving up. We're enduring to the end. He says, those are the ones that will be saved. So that's what he's asking us to do. He's not asking us to solve all the world's problems and all the things that he mentioned there, but he's asking us to be faithful in it. In verse 27, for as the lightning cometh out of the east and shineth even to the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. And then in verse 42, watch therefore, for ye know not what hour your Lord doth come. But know this, that if the good men of the house had known in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched and would not have suffered his house to be broken up. Therefore, be also ready, for in such an hour as ye think not the Son of Man cometh. Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his Lord hath made ruler over his household to give them meat in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing. Busy in the Lord's work, bearing fruit, being a Christian, teaching and showing others how a Christian should live. Verily I say unto you, that he shall make him ruler over all his goods. But and if that evil servant shall say unto in his heart, my Lord delayeth his coming, and shall begin to smite his fellow servants, and to eat and drink with the drunken, the Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he looketh not for him, and in an hour that he is not aware of, and shall cut him asunder, and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now, after all the statistics that I've shared here and the things that Jesus said was going to be a sign of his coming, where are we at? What do you think? Could he come today? I think he could. And I think we need to be just ready that way every day. And that doesn't mean just sitting and waiting like some have done, but it means being busy in the Lord's work. It means just being prepared and ready, bearing fruit for the Lord, and anticipating his return. It's going to be better and not worse. Shall we kneel to pray?